Hello and welcome to The Agenda this Tuesday, October 4. It's a pleasure to have your company today. My name is Danielle Raphael, taking you through this next hour of talks and tunes from marginalised genders. All the news and culture to come with that too. Massive thank you to Tom, as always, for an excellent edition of On The Record and some really lovely musical selections there. Make sure you restream that at rtrfm.com.au or catch the team On The Record every Monday through to Thursday, 9am to 11am. Today on the agenda, though, we'll be chatting to Professor Marilyn Lake at the University of Melbourne about the burden of care work placed on women and unpacking that through the lens of feminism historically, something I'm super interested in and super interested to learn alongside her. And of course, later in the show, we'll have our weekly Language Lab chat with the wonderful Celeste Rodriguez-Leroux from UWA. This week, getting into gender and leadership. Make sure you hang around for that one a bit later on in the program. If you want to reach out, you can send me an SMS on 0405 921 921 or email in studio at rtrfm.com.au. Now, viewing our social responsibilities through the lens of economics does have its issues, and add gender into the mix and we find ourselves once again facing a crisis in our care work industry, with protests and strikes from our nurses, teachers and childcare workers once again on the rise. It begs the question of how long will it take until somebody starts caring about the state of care work? Professor Marilyn at the University of Melbourne is a historian and the author of 13 books, writing with a focus on gender and history. She has held several positions at the Australian Academy of the Humanities, including the International Secretary, Chair of the Academy's Awards Committee, and served two terms as President of the Australian Historical Association between 2010 and 2014. Professor Marilyn joins us now on the agenda to unpack care work and how women play a role in that. Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us on the agenda today.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
Now, firstly, for those of us that may be new to the term, how is care work defined?
Yes, well, care work's actually a relatively recent innovation as a phrase, and it's really useful, I think, because it points to the continuum in the work of care across a whole lot of different sectors that in the past we might have regarded as being quite distinct. That is aged care, childcare, disability, the sick, the young. We now can see more clearly that care work is done by hundreds of thousands of Australians, mainly women, and that usually it's very poorly paid or completely unpaid when done in the home, again, usually by women. So care work's a useful term because it points to the far-reaching broad nature of this sort of work, and it's gender neutral. In other words, anyone could do care work. It happens, as it were now, that it's mainly women who do care work.
That's a great point to make, and I love your use of the word continuum, because there is a spectrum, I guess, of what care work is. And it's something that, I guess, it's at a height politically, and it's in the social consciousness once again, I think, particularly after COVID and the work of care workers kind of came to the fore. But it seems that we hear of action and strikes happening every other week in protest of the conditions of care workers. Here in WA, not that long ago, we had nurses and midwives rally at Fiona Stanley Hospital regarding wages and staff shortages. And earlier in the month, we saw actions taken for our childcare sector. What got us here, do you think, to the point where we are protesting perhaps some of the less than average conditions of our care workers?
Yes, I think many factors have come together. and across these different sectors or industries. For example, there was the Royal Commission into Aged Care that presented its report not long ago. There's a Royal Commission into NDIS. There was the crisis in childcare and aged care caused by COVID particularly. So a whole lot of things have come together. And then on top of that, there's been migration has ceased temporarily because of COVID when borders closed. So there was suddenly a shortage of the sort of people, the migrants, the women who would do care work, particularly in places like aged care and in the disability sector. So I think many things came together, and COVID actually highlighted what had been there all along. COVID highlighted how essential these workers are. You know, suddenly politicians started referring to these workers as essential. That was in the context of COVID. But the situation and the exploitation and the oppression of women who do care work has been there for decades, of course. And one of the points I made in my recent article was to say that actually our founding feminists, those who were active around Federation around 1901, when our Commonwealth was created, they were really mindful of the necessity of creating a Commonwealth that had care and welfare, human welfare, at its centre. You know, they argued this again and again. They said that with women's enfranchisement and with their political participation, they said, to quote Rose Scott, a New South Wales suffragist, that a new element would come into political life, a new element. And what she meant was that it would be a more caring world. She referred to a sort of mother-hearted world, by which she meant that people would be cared for. And when you think about it, there are so many groups in society that actually need care, you know, from babies to toddlers to after-school kids to the sick to the aged, so many groups who depend on care work. And these founding feminists knew that. They knew that back in 1901, and they wanted to create a new Commonwealth because they were enfranchised in 1902 that would attend to the needs of all these people. But sadly, that did not come about. Their vision was not realised. And instead, after some decades, women were encouraged to go into the workforce on the same terms as men. Mm-hmm. And that was a real problem because men's patterns of work were predicated on the fact that men didn't take care of people, you know, that men were free of family and domestic responsibilities. So that's how work was traditionally framed, that it would be done by autonomous people who didn't need to look after anyone else.
Sure. And we'll elaborate on that vision a little bit later on in the chat. But I'm wondering if you could just take it back slightly, Marilyn, and just kind of unpack why is it women specifically that are pigeonholed into these care working roles? Because we mentioned at the start that it's, you know, it's not gender exclusive. But why do we often see women in these roles, in these caring roles in society?
Well, it's a really good question, isn't it?
And I'm not sure.
And I'm not sure that anyone can provide the complete answer to that. Clearly, we're looking at traditions of work, so that the traditions of work whereby women look after other people and children and the old, those traditions have been in place a long time and they continue. Clearly, we're looking at the continuum between the kinds of work that women do unpaid in the home, you know, looking after children, families, the sick, and the kinds of work they went into to be paid for. There's a continuum there. You know, a lot of women go from doing care work at home to doing care work out there in the workforce. There's that continuum. There are assumptions, of course, about femininity and masculinity, and that women are better at caring, that they're more instinctive, a whole lot of things. We now see, of course, more men coming in to do care work. You know, there are more men, male nurses. There are some men working in childcare and kindergarten. There are some men in aged care, but they're very, very few. And one reason I think that more men don't take it up is it's so poorly paid. So it's like a sort of vicious circle, you know, that the work that's poorly paid men generally ignore. I mean, they'd rather be in the construction industry. And I think it's a really good comparison to compare the care industry and the construction industry, you know, in terms of the wages and the perks and the rewards and the status.
And it's, you know, care work, because it is associated with women's work, has historically been, you know, not economically viable because it is women's work. You're listening to The Agenda on RTRFM 92.1, and we're chatting to Professor Marilyn Lake at the University of Melbourne about the crisis in care work. Marilyn, what are the issues that arise when we view the act of care through the prism of economics? As we mentioned, you know, a lot of men, but people generally, they're not wanting to take up these care roles anymore because of the poor working conditions and poor pay. So what are some issues that come up there?
Yes, indeed. I mean, as many now recognise, including the current new federal Labor government, that the wages of care workers have to be lifted quickly and drastically. I mean, currently many, many care workers barely earn the minimum wage, you know, around $20 an hour. Their wages have to be lifted to recognise the value of care work and the skills involved in care work. I mean, a lot of people sort of probably assume that care work doesn't require any skills. It requires a whole range of skills. It requires education. It requires training. And it also demands that these people doing this work be paid much higher wages. I mean, as I said, we should think about equivalent wages to the construction industry or engineering or something like that, you know. So one of the crucial issues is the need to raise wages of care workers. The problem is, of course, that many of the care workers are paid by the government, in effect, and thus that's an extra cost for government. But in fact, a lot of care workers have also been privatised, and so there's pressure there too to keep the wages of care workers down, particularly on the part of you know, childcare centres and aged care homes working for profit. You know, they want to suppress the wages of those workers. Related to that, and economically, is migration. There's a big push now, as everyone will know, to get migration started again, because they want to bring in hundreds of thousands of migrants who can do this work and do it fairly cheaply, who won't be presumably, you know, as activist in the labour force as workers who've grown up in Australia. So the key issue, I think, is to lift wages and to lift conditions and standards to attract more people into an industry that's actually growing. You know, one of the issues, again, we talked before about what's going on now. There's the ageing population of Australia. I mean, I think it's no accident now with the ageing of the baby boomers themselves all now going, you know, needing care, et cetera. That there's an increasing and massive demand for new workers to engage in care work, and also, you know, with the sort of spread of mental illnesses and conditions like dementia, there's yet more need for care workers. So this is a crisis. Everybody recognises it's a crisis, and there's a shortage of workers across all these sectors. So we need to find more workers.
Mm. Tell us about the vision of early Australian feminists. We touched on it earlier, but what did they originally call for and how did they approach the concept of care work?
Yes, well, it's really interesting because, and not many people know this at all, but the founding feminists, those active in the decades in the 1890s, 1900s, 1920s, they had a vision that the Commonwealth, the new Commonwealth of Australia, would be a Commonwealth of care. They thought that the enfranchisement of women and women's political participation would not just mean same, you know, the same as usual. They thought that this would bring a new element into political life. They had a vision for a new kind of society that would be based on human welfare. They often said that they wanted a welfare state and not a warfare state. You know, that money should be put into addressing human welfare. They were very articulate about this and very consistent right across all the states in Australia. They propounded this new vision. They were really excited at the possibility of a new Commonwealth in which women had equal political rights and a new Commonwealth which would design a new nation state. So they thought there was a real possibility. They were very excited at the beginning of this new century. But sadly, they were increasingly disillusioned. One of the schemes they advocated, because they recognised that care work was real work, I mean, this was a key insight, you know, that care work was real work. It was hard work. It was taxing work. They said that while women had small children, for example, they should be paid by the state to do this care work, because they thought, well, women can't be in two places at once. They can't be out in the workforce earning their living and while they're looking after their children. So they said the state should pay a form of what they call motherhood endowment to enable women to be economically independent. This was a key feminist plank. They thought all women should be economically independent. So they shouldn't become dependent housewives. You know, just because they had people to look after at home, they shouldn't become dependent on men. They should be economically independent because now they were equal citizens. So they thought the state should step in, you know, and provide independent incomes for women when they were working in care work at home. And there was a Royal Commission, actually, at the Commonwealth level to investigate the feasibility of this in 1927. And some of the witnesses, it's very interesting to read, some of the witnesses at that Royal Commission, they came from the Labor Party, they came from trade unions, they came from they came from business, and there were also feminist organisations. And one of the Royal Commissioners was really puzzled by these feminists, and he said to one of them, "You mean you're proposing that the state would pay women to look after their children and so they could live apart from their husbands?" And she said, "Yes, it is revolutionary, and that is what we want." And so they were quite straightforward and quite clear-sighted about the radical nature of what they were proposing. But they weren't successful. And by the 1930s, when working women in the paid workforce were being attacked for having paid jobs, then feminists switched tack and switched their strategy. And they decided they had to defend women being in paid work, you know, while they were being attacked. Mm. And so Muriel Hegney, for example, wrote a book called Are Women Taking Men's Jobs? And she helped found the Council of Action for Equal Pay. So they switched tack to try and enable women to go on into the workforce on the same terms as men. And the trouble is, though, that, of course, women generally who have to care for people don't go into the workforce on the same terms as men. They've got to find people to look after, you know, their kids, etc. So it's a very long and interesting history as feminists tried to grapple with this intractable problem.
Yes, it's incredibly interesting. And some of the impacts are still felt and seen today. We're going to have to wrap up quickly, Marilyn, but before I do let you go, you write in your article about the issue that if women stop looking after those in need, what will happen? Where do you think the future of how we relate to care work and our attitudes towards care work is headed?
Yes, I think there's a deep anxiety about in this crisis of care at the moment. You know, what if women just stop looking after people? What will happen then to society? Men fear what will happen if women stop doing this work. And so that's precipitated this sense of crisis. We can only hope that care work, which is essential and will become even more essential, that care work becomes decently remunerated. You know, care workers get paid good wages, they work good conditions, they have short shifts. And so, therefore, there'll be more people attracted into the industry because care work's really important, you know. It shouldn't be seen as drudgery or as unskilled or whatever. It's really skilled, rewarding, important work.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of emotional labour goes into that sort of work too, which is, you know, personally and professionally taxing too.
Absolutely. That's why it's quite distinctive work. Again, when you asked at the beginning what was care work, that's another element of it, that it combines, you know, mental and manual, physical, but also emotional labour. All of those things are wrapped up into it, which makes it so taxing, and therefore it should be properly valued and paid for.
A great way to end it there. Thank you so much, Professor Marilyn Lake, for your time this morning.
Okay, a pleasure. Thanks.
What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of a leader? Is it a man in a business suit in a confident pose or directing a team of people? Well, you're probably not alone in thinking that way, considering how positions of power and authority have been very much male-dominated throughout history. So how are the women leaders among us using language to get a fighting chance in this field? Once again, we have Dr. Celeste Rodriguez-Leroux to talk all about gender and today diving into leadership and how language in that sphere varies. Celeste, good morning.
Good morning.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show and chat with you. Let's get stuck straight into it. How is leadership divided based on gender? And of course, you know, looking at this through a binary lens here, but how can you start by explaining that?
Yeah, we sort of need, I think, the binary lens just to understand the history of this. So historically, institutional leadership has been conducted mostly by cis men, and particularly in some fields and areas of the world, this, unfortunately, is still very much the case. This is a patriarchal sort of take on leadership, and it comes from maybe a historical division of labor where women do the caring, as you were just discussing, and men do the leading, and a resulting sort of social view, societal view that men are better suited than people of other genders to be in positions of power, which of course is not true at all. But what's interesting, given that this is a language lab, is that these views are very much sort of like indexed in the language that we use. Listeners may remember previous episodes where we discussed terms such as chairman as predating a more gender-inclusive option of chairperson. And we were saying back then that these terms reflect, obviously, who is likely to chair a company, for example, but then we were telling people to maybe stay away from them because they just reinforce this view and we're trying to move away from that. So it's a really interesting question and a really interesting link between what has historically been a very, very much a male-dominated working world and changes in the language.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on there that, you know, female leaders aren't an anomaly, but they are a minority. So how do they use language to get ahead and gain respect, I guess, in environments that are structured in a way that favour men?
Yeah, and that is most environments, as we know, still. So, and you know, when we say leadership here, of course, it can be leadership at a number of different levels, but what we want is for people other than white cis men to get to positions of power. And so in doing that, and this is relatively controversial because telling women that they need to change the way they use language or the way they behave, and language is, of course, a type of behavior, is controversial because you're sort of asking people not to be themselves. But
yeah,
this happens.
It's a hard one because you don't want to have to assimilate, do you? You still want to be able to, I guess, get to where you are on your own merits and, you know, your own personality and all that, those types of things too. So it's a tricky one.
Yes, it's a difficult one. But there are various examples throughout history of powerful women, very powerful women, who have actually made a conscious choice to use a more masculine speech style. So I'll tell you about these. And what I mean by a more masculine speech style here is, for example, the lowering of their pitch,
right,
the pitch in their voice to sound more dominant. And we know that that is a key aspect of the way that we use our voice, research on perceptions of pitch in women's voices, so how that pitch is perceived, shows that higher pitch tends to be associated with physical attractiveness, while a lower pitch is associated with dominance. And so someone who is very conscious of this, and listeners may have actually watched the movie about this, is Margaret Thatcher, so the British Prime Minister. And what Thatcher actually did was she received voice training to sound more like a man. She altered the pitch of her voice. She trained herself to use a lower pitch so that she could get stuff done.
I can't help
be taken seriously.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, I can't help think of, the rise of a lot of AFL women commentators. And I've noticed and I've spoken to people about how you can kind of, it's like they're trying to assimilate their pitch and their pace and the tone of their voice to what a male commentator would typically sound like. And I don't know whether that's an advantage or a disadvantage, but I understand why women who are, in those positions might need to do that or might want to do that.
Yeah, and, it's a really interesting example because a lot of the times the way that we use language become sort of like set in stone, and it's just like the way that a particular thing is done, and so then people become part of that culture, but maybe what they don't know is that that culture is very much patriarchal. There's a really good example, which may be more of an anecdote, if not as we don't really know whether this was a thing, but a couple of years ago when Elizabeth Holmes, who was the founder of a fraudulent biotech company, she was suspected as well of putting on a lower pitch, and some people were sort of assuming that that was sort of like a power play to allow for her company to resonate with investors. And interestingly, most, if not all, of her advisory board was extremely successful cis men. So whether that is true or not, I think the takeaway message as well for our listeners is that how come we are so observant and so kind of keen to understand the way that women use language? Would we be asking a man to change the way he speaks to become a more successful leader? And so this kind of brings up the policing of women's language, and that is something we'll be touching on at a later point in time in Language Lab. But yeah, they're very interesting questions.
Incredibly so. You're listening to The Agenda. You're on the Language Lab today with Celeste Rodriguez-Luro. Now, Celeste, does culture play a part in influencing language use in leadership? We kind of did touch on, the culture of perhaps sport, but how else does that come into play?
Yeah, the culture of sport was a really good example, but you can also kind of take it, take that to be a more sort of a broader definition of culture where you just look at how leadership is done around the world. And cultural norms totally affect gender roles in leadership. So in a culture where respect and formality, according to someone's age or seniority, are essential in communication in terms of sort of defining and deciding what kinds of grammar you need to use, what kind of honorifics or classifiers you're going to be using, then that totally affects how more junior members will speak to more senior members and vice versa. For women in particular, if women or non-cisgender men are seen as lower in rank, in a particular culture, then they will be expected to speak using a deferential style, especially when addressing male counterparts. And so that may actually take place regardless of their rank. So one really good example is some research focusing on the speech of a female CEO in Hong Kong. And this shows that taking on a more masculine approach with minimal feminine strategies may be the way to go in this context. So the female CEO in Hong Kong was seen as adopting sort of different ways of interacting, sort of dropping a lot of hedging, which women are known to do, less questions being asked. And she was doing that because these higher positions are very much still male dominated in Hong Kong, and she was trying to get there and succeed.
What an incredible case study, and I'm sure there's many more. A great place to leave it on, Celeste. Thank you once again for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure.